in sending out positive vibes and displaying courage to everyone. He was a symbol of international resistance who redefined the rules of leadership.
General Soleimani is well known for dislodging Daesh terrorists in Iraq back in 2017. He also spearheaded major operations in Syria that resulted in liberating key areas from Daesh control. Observers say by assassinating General Soleimani, the U.S. tried to resurrect the terrorists. However, they call it a miscalculation which backfired on Washington, triggering the beginning of its exit from the region.
Although the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani put an end to his life, his legacy will continue forever, and he will remain as a role model for all resistance and anti-terrorism Karens. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Afghan people from different walks of life have gathered at Iran's cultural center to mark the third assassination anniversary of anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani. Participants expressed sympathy with the Iranian nation, saying that General Soleimani was a hero for the entire region.
The pain and grief of the loss of the great martyr Soleimani does not only belong to Iranians. Sardar Soleimani is the hero and flag bearer of the fight against terrorism in the region. He played a very significant and decisive role in our world.
It's the duty of the Muslim world to call for justice for General Soleimani. This huge crime, the killing of a Muslim Iranian general by the U.S., should be investigated by the U.N. Commander Soleimani was targeted by the U.S. when he was busy fighting international terrorism and U.N.-designated terrorist groups.
Participants also say that Commander Soleimani played a key role in the defeat of the Daesh terrorist group in West Asia and in the fight against international criminals.
Commander Soleimani, as a commander of Islam, was there for Muslims everywhere. He was active and supported oppressed people in Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and Bosnia-Herzegovina. Likewise, he was involved in a fight against the Afghans in Afghanistan, too. He trained and directed Afghans to defend their soil against invaders and maintain their freedom. Commander Soleimani fought in a campaign for the freedom of Muslim Ummah.
Along with other admirers of General Soleimani, Afghans every year commemorate the legacy and life of the anti-terrorism hero. Afghan people have long been fighting for their freedom. They remember General Soleimani as a leader and a role model for them and for all freedom seekers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
The Iranian army's radars have spotted a hostile UAV flying 25,000 feet above its southern waters. Its mission was to strike sensitive Iranian military facilities. The army quickly operated its homegrown Talosh missile system, and this is what happened to the intruding drone. This scenario was part of the last phase of a large-scale military drill held over an area stretching from the Strait of Hormuz all the way to the Sea of Oman and north of the Indian Ocean.
The drills cover a 3 million square kilometer area. They aim to test the preparedness of our young personnel and our military equipment that have recently been added to our fleet. Our military might send the message of peace and friendship to our neighbors, but to our enemies, it's a show of power and deterrence.
The three-day maneuver saw the deployment of several pieces of domestically built equipment, from drones and missile systems to warships, submarines, and tanks. The country has been building up its defense arsenal against the backdrop of the West's arms embargoes on Tehran. The army says today it is capable of protecting the country's land, air, and sea borders using locally developed hardware.
All of the systems used in these maneuvers have been developed domestically. They are designed to hit targets at different altitudes. These exercises show that we, as the Air Defense Force, along with other branches of the Army, are fully capable of defending our country using military technologies that have been fully developed domestically.
The Army's Air Defense Force also used its Mirsad missile systems to strike hostile air targets. The Army says it's working on more advanced missile systems to further bolster its deterrent power.
Engages all of the four branches of the Iranian army, including its air defense force, just deployed its latest homegrown missile systems. The Army says this is to boost synergy between its different units, to be ready to confront any potential threats to its territorial waters. Yusuf Jalali from the location of the drill.
The Center for Political and International Studies of the Iranian Foreign Ministry has organized a specialized roundtable focusing on the fight against terrorism and extremism in the West Asia region. Guests and attendees from different Iranian institutions and bodies took part in the forum, which concentrated on efforts made by the Iranian anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Among the most significant topics discussed during the meeting were fighting terrorism in the West Asia region from the point of view of international law, the role of General Soleimani in fighting terrorism in the West Asia region, and the role of the United Nations in fight on terror in the West Asia region. On the sidelines of the meeting, Iran's former ambassador to Iraq, Iraj Masjidi, highlighted the late commander's role in neutralizing terrorist groups in neighboring countries.
When Lieutenant General Soleimani was assassinated, I was working as the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Iraq. He would frequently travel to Iraq in order to confront the ISIS terrorist group and help the Iraqi armed forces and Hashd al-Sha'bi with planning and logistic support. In other words, he played a prominent role in Iraq in the fight against terrorists.
Masjidi also said that efforts to bring a prosecution against those involved in the assassination of General Soleimani continues. In this regard, the head of a special Iranian committee tasked with pursuing the case of General Soleimani's assassination in domestic and international courts said an indict on the assassination will be announced soon. He was referring to a report by a UN expert on extrajudicial killings concluding that the targeting of General Soleimani and those accompanying him constitute an arbitrary killing for which the U.S. is responsible.
Iran has had a significant role in the fight against terrorism in the West Asia region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. And Iran's top anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, played a pivotal role in combating terrorism and defeating Daesh. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Brits are still reeling from the impact of 2022. It's hard to recall a political year that's seen the country lurch from one crisis to the next. All bookended, it seems, by the saga of which particular Conservative Prime Minister was in charge. Boris Johnson had managed to cling on to power despite mounting evidence presented that his position had become untenable. His missteps during lockdown, dubbed Partygate, a faltering economy exacerbated by the outbreak of conflict in Ukraine, made his departure an inevitability. The race to replace him was brutal, exposing the deep divisions within the Conservatives. Party members chose Liz Truss over Sunak before, but that was only the beginning of the saga. Analyst Chris Bambury was following events closely and reflects on that period of chaos.
We had this strange interim where Liz Truss beat Sunak, clearly showing that a majority of the Conservative Party membership were not going to vote for Sunak for reasons which I think are fairly obvious, which are never really talked about. But Truss was a disaster. And then we ended up with Sunak being shoehorned into the Prime Ministership with no actual election.
I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Ah, the blink and you'll miss it Truss era. 7 weeks of chaos which saw the pound take a hit and the markets recoil at the sheer ineptitude on political display. There was a sense that the UK's political landscape had now become a running joke.
The chaos of the Liz Truss premiership, you know, was just awesome. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that in British politics. British politics is supposed to be about stability. It prides itself in selling itself, Britain, as a brand to the rest of the world that has been politically stable. This was like Italian politics. You know, and prime ministers just coming and going. This did not give a vision of Britain as a stable political entity.
Not content with topsy-turvy politics, the UK's longest-serving monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, passed away age 96, leaving the UK contemplating its colonial legacy. With King Charles III with Camilla, Queen Consort, by his side, it was a new era, but one filled with old uncertainties.
I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands.
Despite the passing of the baton, the impact of Brexit, the stalemate in the north of Ireland, with the cost of living crisis biting, Prime Minister's in-tray was bulging. 2022 is also the year Britain saw a re-emergence of strike action across a multitude of sectors.
We have been reasonable, but it is impossible to find a negotiated settlement when the dead hand of the government is presiding over and blocking a resolution in these talks.
We are seeing the recovery of industrial unrest, workers taking trade union action, and finding that when they go on strike, they are popular, that people sympathise with them, sections of the working class and indeed the middle class. And I think that spells trouble ahead. These strikes, we haven't seen anything like this in Britain really since the days of Margaret Thatcher. This is new, and I think people are learning new habits, new skills of taking industrial disputes. And I think potentially this is a bit of a game changer down the road.
Rishi Sunak and the rest of his Conservative government will be desperately hoping that there is not a repeat of the past tumultuous year. A 12-month period that's seen record number of Brits slide into poverty. But analysts are warning that desperate changes need to happen because so far it seems the Tories are heavy on excuses and light on solutions. On the cusp of a new year, there are many challenges awaiting the average British family. Whoever is in charge in Downing Street, it's the most vulnerable who continue to pay the heaviest price. Without firm solutions from the political class, it seems the upcoming period might hold still more pain for those who can ill afford it. Amina Taylor, London.
South Korea plans to significantly boost military spending over the next 5 years, an annual increase of nearly 7%. The Eastern Asian country aims to spend over $440 million on anti-drone weapons alone. The announcement comes only days after North Korea flew drones into the South's territory for the first time in 5 years.
According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, Monday, five North Korean drones crossed the border before breaking formation. Four of them headed to islands in the West Sea, while one of the drones continued south, reaching the skies over the outskirts of this city, the capital, Seoul.
It was the first such incident since 2017 when a drone crossed into South Korea and photographed a U.S. base here. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, a conservative who came to office in May of this year, has blamed the previous progressive government's policy of engaging Pyongyang for the recent incident.
Given that efforts or military training to respond to such UAV drones have never been properly done since 2017, I think our people must have well seen how dangerous a policy relying on the North's good faith and peace agreements would be.
South Korea plans more joint military exercises with the U.S. for 2023, although much of the public wants talks with North Korea and a de-escalation of tensions. Meanwhile, North Korea has unveiled new goals for the country's military. Addressing a large committee meeting of the ruling Workers' Party, leader Kim Jong-un indicated on Wednesday that the country will continue its military development in 2023 after a record year of missile testing. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the limelight.
U.S. Representative Rashida Tlaib has released a statement after voting against the FY23 National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA, saying, "I voted against the $847 billion so-called defense budget, the largest ever in the history of our country, while the needs of working families are neglected here at home. This package was $45 billion more than President Biden even requested. It's outrageous that every year we spend more on our military weapons and war Then the next 9 countries combined, including China, India, Russia, the UK, Saudi Arabia, Germany, France, Japan, and South Korea. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, the U.S. House of Representatives has backed legislation that paves the way for the military budget to hit a record $858 billion next year. The massive amount of funds even surpasses the amount proposed by President Joe Biden by $45 billion. The Fiscal 2023 National Defense Authorization Act authorizes $858 billion in military spending and includes funding for further purchases of weapons, warships, and warplanes. The measure was passed following months of negotiations between Republicans and Democrats in both the Senate and the House. The bill paves the way for more funds to develop new weapons and purchase systems, including Lockheed Martin Corp F-35 fighter jets and ships made by General Dynamics. The massive military policy bill also includes authorization of up to $10 billion in military assistance and fast-tracked weapons procurement for Taiwan. This is likely to be met with anger from Beijing, which views Taiwan as an integral part of China. Beijing is growing increasingly frustrated with Washington's disregard towards Chinese territory, accusing the U.S. of interference in its domestic affairs. Beijing also accuses Washington of using Taiwan to contain China's growing economic and military strength. This is despite the fact that experts say China has no ambitions to become the number one superpower in the world, as the U.S. is attempting to do so. Washington appears eager to raise tensions in East Asia, with the Pentagon's focus on China. In the summer, Washington sharply raised tensions after former U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi paid a highly controversial visit to Taiwan. Despite America's attempts to contain another sovereign country's capabilities, China sent a new remote sensing satellite into space from the Taiwan Satellite Launch Center in North China's Shaanxi Province at 2:31 a.m. local time recently. The satellite Gaofen 5-01A was launched abroad, a Long March 2D rocket, and entered its planned orbit successfully. It is a hyperspectral satellite that will be used for remote sensing and applications in diverse fields, such as pollution reduction, environmental monitoring, natural resource surveys, and climate change studies. The satellite will help improve the country's hyperspectral observation capacity in areas such as environmental protection, land, weather, agriculture, and disaster alleviation. The launch was the 453rd flight mission of the Long March carrier rocket series. The House passed a version of the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, an annual must-pass bill setting policy for the Pentagon by 350-80, far exceeding the two-thirds majority required to pass the legislation. The U.S. security budget legislation will now head to the Senate for a vote and will also need a rubber stamp from President Biden. Both measures are expected to pass with ease. The bill also provides Ukraine with at least $800 million in additional military assistance next year and includes a range of provisions to strengthen Taiwan's military. This comes as the U.S. is preparing to send Ukraine a further $275 million military aid package, offering new capabilities to defeat drones and strengthen air defenses, according to a document seen by officials familiar with the package. Details of the anti-drone and air defense equipment included have not been determined. The Pentagon is also expected to include rockets for High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, HIMARS launchers made by Lockheed Martin Corps, 155mm ammunition, Humvee military vehicles, and generators, according to the people and the document. A National Security Council spokesperson declined to comment on aid package. The contents and size of aid packages can shift until they are signed by the president. The $275 million will be covered by Presidential Drawdown Authority, PDA, which allows the U.S. to transfer defense articles and services from stocks quickly without congressional approval in response to an emergency. The U.S. has sent sophisticated anti-aircraft NASAMS systems to Ukraine, which have been running for a few weeks. Washington previously announced it was also sending Hawk interceptor missiles, as well as the U.S. is preparing to send Ukraine a $275 million military aid package offering new capabilities to defeat drones and strengthen air defenses, according to people familiar with the package. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment, and a National Security Council spokesperson declined to comment on the aid package. The contents and size of aid packages can shift until they are signed by the president. Washington previously announced it was sending 4 Avenger short-range air defense systems that use Stinger missiles made by Raytheon Technologies Corps and Hawk interceptor missiles. U.S. allies have also been sending air defense systems since the start of the Russia-Ukraine conflict on February 24th. Since then, the U.S. has sent almost $20 billion worth of military assistance to Kiev. Washington's allies such as Britain, France, and Canada have also been sending aid packages for Ukraine. Russia, however, has time and again warned that the continued supply of Western weapons and military equipment to Kiev will only prolong the conflict. The Kremlin recently said Moscow is intensifying its operations in Ukraine in an attempt to force Kiev to the negotiating table and end the crisis. According to Putin, these Ukrainian acts amount to genocide. He also said that the international uproar over strikes would not hinder Russia's missions in Ukraine. Russian authorities accuse Ukrainian forces of heavily shelling the eastern Donetsk region. The war in Ukraine has entered its 10th month, with both sides accusing the other of targeting civilian centers. Russian authorities accused the Ukrainian forces of heavily shelling the eastern Donetsk region. Critics argue the U.S. is seeking a stalemate in the country to contain Russia by sending more advanced weapons to Kiev to prolong the war. At the same time, reports have emerged that Washington is sending out-of-date weapons to Kiev when Ukrainian forces are advancing. Meanwhile, Reuters reported the U.S. House of Representatives backed legislation recently, paving the way for defense budget to hit a record $858 billion next year, $45 billion more than proposed by President. The House passed the compromised version of the National Defense Authorization Act, or NDAA, an annual must-pass bill-setting policy for the Pentagon. by 350-84, exceeding the two-thirds majority required to pass the legislation and send it for a vote in the Senate. The fiscal 2023 NDAA authorizes $858 billion in military spending and includes a 4.6% pay increase for the troops, funding for purchases of weapons, ships and aircraft, and support for Taiwan. This bill in Congress is exercising its authority to authorize and do oversight, said Representative Adam Smith, the Democratic chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, in a speech urging support for the measure.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
March the anniversary of revered Iranian commander Shah Qasem Soleimani is here. Millions of Iranians and admirers worldwide have marked this day with tributes to this anti-terror icon, who is literally the mastermind behind eradicating Daesh terrorists from Iraq and also in Syria and elsewhere. But his targeted assassination ordered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump ended his life, and Iranians and Iranian officials will never forget that. What he symbolized and what motives were behind this U.S. assassination are two of the angles that we will be covering in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Mahlo Osman, journalist and political analyst, joins us from Beirut. Also joining us is Daniel Jedzic, author and researcher, who joins us from Barcelona. Welcome to you both.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Marwa Osman, I'll start with you. The third-year anniversary of the late Commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The wounds are still very fresh, and it's almost as if this happened yesterday. The U.S. assassination, obviously, is something that people will not forget about what has happened. I mean, he was such a grand figure, as some have called him, a hero without borders. What is your impression at this point, 3 years to have passed since that dreadful day?
Condolences again to the nation, to the Ummah, to the Iranian nation, and as well to the free people of the world for the third anniversary of the martyrdom of Hajj Qasem Soleimani and his comrade Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Now, when we speak about these two people, and specifically Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, we don't speak about just the person or what that person actually symbolizes. We speak about a school, an ideology. We speak about a wave of resistance that struck from the eastern part of Asia to the western part of Asia to try and help the people of this region, to the natives of this region, to liberate themselves and liberate their lands, their resources, their detainees, and to fight colonialism and imperialism. Hajj Qasem Soleimani, since the early late 80s, early 90s, has had a very specific role in supporting the national resistance in each of West Asia's countries, specifically speaking, Palestine, Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and later on Yemen, as well as his work in Afghanistan as well. But specifically in my region, where I come from, where I'm a native in my land, Hajj Qasem Soleimani is a symbol of not only liberation, but also standing with the oppressed people. You don't only call for the liberation of the people, you stand with the oppressed. You stand with them not only morally, but also practically on the ground, meaning you give whatever you can possibly give to help them stand up in the face of this occupation or this aggression. This is exactly what Hajj Qasem Soleimani did, which is why his symbolism, his martyrdom affected not only the people of his region, but it transcended across the borders. It went even across Asia, all over the world. I mean, the trips that I took this past year alone, where people were asking me about Hajj Qasem Soleimani, was magical, from Havana to Moscow to elsewhere. Wherever we go, people would like to know more about his personality, more about how he helped. And when we talk about things that the media usually doesn't show, people are in awe. For example, how he helped his own nation when it was flooded in certain areas of Iran, when he helped, and when he was on the front lines in Iraq and in Syria, they had no idea. When we show videos of those events that the mainstream media never shows, they are in awe and in shock, and they fall more in love with this symbolism of a hero being brought into daylight by his martyrdom, not only by the activities and the support that he gave to the resistance of this region.
Sure. That last point that you made, and aside from that, obviously he's a very humble person, to add to that, but that last point is what I'd like to ask you, the last point that Marwa Osman made, Daniel Yejic, when it comes to the resistance. Iran's leader just days ago said that Hajj Qasem Soleimani actually was a force that, after the assassination happened, also it has become very clear that it actually boosted, reinvigorated, and gave additional strength to the resistance in the region. And that says a lot, because it covers, obviously, major groups. Can you tell us in what ways that has happened, if you agree?
Yes, absolutely agree with what has been said, especially when you think about in terms of the resistance and the symbolism that is embodied by his persona, by the way that he has been received and commemorated publicly across Iran, the region, and internationally. And I think that his martyrdom symbolizes or shows just again the very strength of the resistance in the region, and that it continues to organize and to cooperate throughout Western Asia and beyond against this very internationally and structurally organized terror of colonialism, imperialism, and Zionism. And I think that the reactions to his martyrdom that we've seen internationally in the last 3 years have also shown how important this person was for also unifying, again, this school of thought, the idea, the ideology, and beyond that, the ideas of liberation, of solidarity that are so important that still continue based on his ideas, based on his ideologies and thoughts, continue to flourish in the region and continue to pose another significant threat to the ongoing colonialism, which I think also then brings us again to the question why he was assassinated. There is this very particular strength about this person that obviously has been identified as a major threat for the foreign forces that have been involved in destabilizing and terrorizing Iran and the region for years and decades now.
When you take a look at the reasoning, I know this has been hashed out in some respects, Marwa Usman, but we have to go through it because in the little time that we have left, it's worthy to review this if we can. And the Agnes Callamard, the U.N. Special Rapporteur, said that the U.S. was not justified for the attack, had not provided sufficient evidence. And the evidence that the U.S. gave was no evidence. It said that he was planning an imminent attack against U.S. interests. I mean, I don't know if you remember when Mike Pompeo, the former U.S. Secretary of State, came out and said that. He was planning an attack, particularly in Iraq. And therefore, immediate action had to take place. You know, this just doesn't fly. Why is that aspect of the illegality of this, to say the least, not taken up with the U.S. in an international court of justice or some kind of court or somewhere where, you know, the U.S. should be found guilty of it?
Because they are themselves, they declare that they are themselves the police of the world. They are above any kind of law. I mean, the U.S. is currently having war, illegal war. When I say illegal, I don't mean on an international level. I say illegal within the laws of the United States of America. They are engaged in 7 illegal wars that they have never taken as military. They did not take the permission of their own Congress for it to be involved in it, so they don't even abide by their own laws, not only by international law. So we're talking about an actual entity that is spreading terrorism, that brings benefit, that brings resources, and that brings more money and more hegemony to that entity that's residing in Washington, D.C. This is something that we only read about in history, like the likes of Rome or certain, for example, kingdoms in the East that were taking over swaths of land and being hegemonic against its people and stealing its resources and taking taxes from the people. This is exactly what we read throughout history, but it's with technology, it's with drones, it's with military capability, and it's with hegemonic power in diplomacy as well, where they always find some sort of a window to justify or give themselves the right to operate the way they do. I mean, even if it was in a battlefield, I would have at least respected an enemy that fights back in the battlefield. But Hash Qasem Soleimani was on a diplomatic visit to Iraq. He was having a political situation that he was dealing with in Iraq. It was not a military visit, because we all knew Hash Qasem Soleimani. When he wanted to be on the ground militarily, he would cross from Syria to Iraq from the borders which the Mujahideen liberated. He wouldn't have taken the airplane to begin with, but the Americans, along with the Mossad, because Israel played a big part in this assassination, they were very keen on killing the man, and it happened that Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the comrade and the longtime friend of Qasem Soleimani, was there to receive them at the airport, that two of the greatest commanders in our region were taken out in one blow. But when the United States of America tries to give out a justification, no one in the world, even their own allies, believe that this justification is legalized or legitimate or actually has any sense. They just play police, but at the, right, the real time, they are gangsters. It's a big institution that has big guns, big money, that tries to take control of other nations. This is what the United States of America is.
Well, if they have big guns and they have big machinery in the military arena, Donald Trump is missing something else. because it came out later that Trump had said and confessed that he's afraid. He's afraid that there's going to be a retaliation and that Iran would try to assassinate him. That's how scared he was. And especially at the event, he said he has to fly back to Washington where he could be safer. And two of the other things that he said, which I found interesting to ask you, Daniel Yajic, is first he said Soleimani was plotting an imminent and sinister attack on American diplomats. We covered that. But we caught him in the act. I find that to be interesting. And terminated him. And then he said that if he hadn't done that, that there would be a war between the United States and Iran. Those two statements are kind of odd, aren't they?
Yes, they are. But also, I don't think we should be expecting any logic or reasoning behind justifications that the United States administration has been providing for its extraterritorial violence and killing of people in Western Asia and beyond. And I think if we look at these particular statements that you just outlined, they're also representative of this very broad political communications that the U.S. administration has been using for decades now, where people are identified as threats, as so-called terrorists, although there isn't even a proper definition of what that term should or could entail. So there's a very particular language that is being used to dehumanize people and to convert them rhetorically into threats that could be eliminated in order to create consent for the killing. And I think, it is very similar to the justifications that are being used on a daily basis for the killings of individual Palestinians. If we want to look at another context where any sort of colonial or imperial violence is justified as being some sort of self-defense or some sort of an act that would prevent further violence against the United States. So this entire rhetoric is very much just trying to find a reasoning and, again, to add all of these Orientalist and Islamophobic narratives that there already are to their own audience in order to justify those killings. But also beyond that, I think we should also just ask the question why there is even this discourse that is being led by the United States in which they are justifying their invasions and their illegal incursions into Iran, Iraq, and other places in Western Asia to begin with. Because the entire discourse is, again, based on some sort of justification. There is a reason why the United States should be involved or should be present militarily in Western Asia to begin with. Yeah, so to come back to the question, I think it is just rhetorically, those were just, again, attempts to justify this very form of, we could call it state terrorism that has been conducted.
You know, I'm really perplexed here, and maybe you could help me out, Marwa Usman, when we take a look at the real reasons when it comes down to why Trump ordered the assassination, even though some say Mike Pompeo actually convinced him to do so, whether the intel on this was correct or whether they really saw Hajj Qasem Soleimani as the figure that stood in the way for the U.S. to execute different types of operations on the ground, whether it be in Iraq or whether it be in Syria or West Asia as a whole. So they saw him as a stumbling block because they obviously didn't understand the relationship between Hajj Qasem Soleimani representing Iran and Iraq. When we're talking about deep cultural and religious links that exist between the two countries and what exists in Iraq in terms of whatever it was that he was doing, which was eradicating the terrorists, some which have been supported by the U.S., then that was in the way. He stood in the way. Isn't that the real reason, perhaps, for the choice that was made to assassinate him?
Definitely. Kaveh, when you look at the timeline of liberating Syria and Iraq, especially the bordering area between Syria and Iraq from Daesh, what's known in the West as ISIS, you see that the timeline led to a fast track to the assassination of Hajj Qasem Soleimani because from late 2017, basically on the New Year's Eve of 2017, up until late 2019, it was fast tracking of liberating areas that were controlled by ISIS, especially areas that are vital for the resistance to move from Iraq to Syria to defend both border lines. And the next step for Iraq in specific was to try and liberate areas in Anbar. And these areas, just like in Syria, the eastern part of the Euphrates, you have the western part of Anbar, where basically the United States of America resides and has military bases there. We see that ISIS only operates there, which has a lot of question mark for the people who don't understand how the U.S. actually aids and trains and funds the likes of ISIS terrorist organizations like ISIS to create havoc in the region. But it was this area which was the next plan for Hajj Qasem Soleimani and the resistance, the Hashd al-Sha'bi, the PMU in Iraq, and the Syrian Arab Army and the affiliates, the national forces as well in Syria, to try to take over these lands and, as well, and to liberate the area, specifically the area where the real heavy resources for both countries are placed. So that was poking a hole in the plan of the United States of America, which is why up until now we saw that these pockets that are occupied and inhabited by U.S. occupation forces are still open for Daesh roaming, and they are the most vital for Syria, for example, and the Umar oil field or the Konik oil field, where if these oil fields are liberated, the economic sanctions against Syria would have no valid critical effect on the people, which is why this was the next phase, the next step, to try to liberate the people economically by giving them their resources back. And that was a big no-no for the empire and its puppet regime here in West Asia, which is the Zionist regime. And they decided to take that plan and make it happen, but they don't really understand that when we lose commanders, we become more motivated ideologically, religiously, and at a national level to move forward, to take that ideology, to learn what we were educated by these commanders and put it on a new level of resistance. That's what they don't understand. Uh-huh. Basically, if they really understood how the revolution in Iran worked and how it's still renewing itself year after year, if they actually understood that, they wouldn't attempt a regime change right now, which failed from week one. They don't understand the ideology, they don't understand the culture, and basically that's our superpower in the resistance.
This fact is really important. It kind of relates back to that question I asked you, Daniel Yejic, when it came to Iran's leader, saying that the resistance is now somewhat like a shot in the arm after that assassination took place. Are we looking at U.S. mishaps and failures as something that they don't learn from? Because that is something that keeps repeating itself. And I'm wondering, to what degree is the U.S. Why it is that they continue down a wrong path when it comes to, well, in this case, since we're talking about Qasem Soleimani, about Iran overall, because they're exerting such pressure that is not helping. And in the case of the assassination, well, Iraq came out, I forget what duration of time, where the lawmakers voted to have the U.S. troops out of the country, to be told to leave the country. These are all foreign policy failures. Why does the U.S. continue down this wrong path?
Yeah, I think that it absolutely misunderstands and continues, despite the presence of the U.S. military in the region for so many decades, and despite Western Asia being a very central not only to U.S. foreign policy, but also to U.S. political identity and its role in the world and its presentation to itself. It still continues to fail to misunderstand the dynamics in the region, but also the fact that there are dynamics such as solidarity and resistance among the people that are based, as Marwa already said, on ideologies and on learning and on advancing. Also, going back to the example that was mentioned, the Iranian Revolution, because on the other side, the United States has, with its allies and proxies in the region, more of a transactional relationship, where the Zionist entity serves as some sort of military base and European proxy colony that is used to develop weapons to oppress indigenous people, and where other regimes have relations with the United States that are based on favors, are based on economic favors and on political violence, whereas we look at a perspective of the resistance, there is a very broad resistance of people in the region, liberating themselves, having lived under different forms of occupation, colonization, terrorism, and in fact, sanctions, and having a very human reactions to that. And I think that the United States continues to misunderstand this, thinking that it could, through its pressure and through economic sanctions and through other forms of state violence, continue to oppress people and subjugate them into changing their ideologies, which obviously is not possible. I think this will continue to be a major failure for the United States, and shows again the strength of the resistance that will eventually obviously prevail and lead to the liberation of Western Asia.
All right. The idea of revenge has been discussed a lot, Marwa Osman, trying to overpower the real importance of Hajj Qasem Soleimani and what he meant overall. They're trying to, the Western media in particular, obviously they're trying to somewhat have that be the overarching theme, that you see Iran now wants to take revenge and trying to demonize Iran in that respect. Now, I'm not here to promote revenge, nor am I a spokesperson for the foreign policy of Iran. But my question somewhat parallels the notion where there has to be something that stops the U.S. from doing this again. Because we had the U.N. report, we've had the condemnations, but the U.S. still will have that kind of an option on its radar because we see its allies doing it, like Israel. So what path can be taken in order to prevent the U.S. and its allies overall to not think that ordering an assassination is okay, since, well, the U.S. has done it, Israel has been doing it, therefore it's okay to do that?
Well, I think that with the initial retaliation that happened on Ain al-Assad Air Base that killed more than 120 U.S. soldiers, if they don't know, we know how to count. We know how to count. We monitor how they announce the fatalities of their own soldiers because they are so afraid to announce that strike actually led to the killing of 120. But over the course of 3 months, we were able to count the casualties that were reported by the U.S. Army, be it by calling it friendly fire or in action. But we understand, we saw the immense power that fell on that military base. And I think that was the initial phase of retaliation, which was the direct military phase of retaliation. But retaliation has been going on since the first day of the assassination with the motivation to keep the struggle going, to keep the resistance alive. And we've seen how on several fronts, the Americans are practically suffering certain losses that they have did not plan to suffer, or they did not think they would be able to suffer, whether be it in the their colony, in the Zionist entity. We did see at several levels, for example, the Al-Quds, the sort of Al-Quds operation in 2020 and 2021. We also saw several retaliation in Syria. We saw how Yemen was steadfast and actually won more land. So it's more of a collective effort at the level of the resistance axis by taking the knowledge and the wisdom of Hajj Qasem Soleimani and moving forward with it. Now, the next phase, obviously, would be to try and disengage the hegemony of the United States of America from the economic crisis that hit the region because of their sanctions, because of their policies that try to suffocate the people now, not to target the military as much as to target the people in order to make the people rise against the resistance. They failed at an ideological level, but I think that the resistance, the new phase that the resistance has entered, which is basically not only a military alliance,